This is episode 681 of the AWS podcast, released on August 19th, 2024.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the AWS podcast. I'm Lish here with you. Great to have you back. I'm joined today by Jason Hunter. Jason is a principal specialist solution architect. He's a guru on many things, but we're going to talk about one thing, which is DynamoDB. Jason, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here.
Good to have you here. Now, you've been doing lots of interesting stuff in the IT world for a long time, and we're not going to get into that today, but just listeners, trust me when I say Jason's seen some stuff and knows some stuff. But today we're going to talk about DynamoDB, and we're going to get pretty deep pretty quick. But just to frame the conversation briefly, Jason, let's just talk about DynamoDB in terms of its scalability, just so people can get a feel of, okay, this thing can run at mega scale, and a little bit about why we created this for our customers.
It's a database that scales to zero, as well as scaling to millions of requests per second. And I've done databases for a long time. And when I helped someone do 11 million writes per second for 10 hours to do a batch load, I mean, you just have to pause and think, that's crazy.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
Big numbers.
Something at that rate. Big numbers. And then afterwards, scaled back to zero until they went live.
And that's tricky. That's you know, it's because on the one hand, anyone can build a big database, quote unquote, but then unbuilding it trivially is not trivial.
The secret there is that it's on a shared architecture on the back. So there's large numbers of servers handling the Dynamo requests. And when you do a lot of requests, you get a bigger share of that pool of resources. And then when you scale to zero, you get a smaller pull of those resources down to zero. And when you're at zero, you really just only have to pay for storage. You don't have to pay for any reads or writes because you're not doing any. We're a little bit used to that with S3.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like the S3 model in the database world.
Exactly.
And so this thing, you know, clearly works at scale. We've got, you know, over a million customers. We've got hundreds of DynamoDB customers who have tables with peak traffic of well over 500,000 requests per second. I mean, it's easy to say that number fast, but that's a scary number.
Such an honor to get to work with these customers.
Yeah, I know. It's like, yeah,
you know, they're all the name brands that you know.
Push it hard.
Real live traffic.
So before we get into the guts of some of the techniques we're going to use and the approaches we can take and the edges, etc., from an architectural perspective, where does an architect or a developer think about, when do I reach for DynamoDB? Like, is it for everything? Is it for certain things? Now, this is a it depends question, but I'm asking it, I guess, to try and help us triangulate on some common use cases and patterns that when you see that, you go, you're looking for DynamoDB.
Sure. Yeah, it's a NoSQL database, so it doesn't behave like a relational database, and that takes some adjustment for people, but it was intentionally designed to be different. It's designed for low latency at any scale. That's our tagline. What that means is that we want your P50 to be low latency. We want your P99 low latency, your P99.9 low latency all day, every day, no maintenance windows, always up. So it's for that kind of application where you're saying, I want to be able to store and retrieve data nonstop, always fast.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to do it even if my user load grows 10x next year.
Yep. Yep. And I don't have to plan for it.
I mean, the origin story is really interesting because it was inspired by an outage that Amazon.com had 20 years ago, where the shopping cart was managed by a relational database. And, it, you know, Amazon was growing so fast that at some point, the relational database just couldn't keep up, caused outage for a while. And that caused them to go back and rethink, well, what is it that we're doing here with a shopping cart that needs relational? And the answer was, some of the things that relational offered weren't required, and we could jettison in order to get other things like the low latency at any scale. And so things you don't do are things like joins and sending unbounded work requests to Dynamo or to the database here, where you would say like, hey, do this work. And if it takes a lot of calculation, just do that calculation for me.
Yeah.
Dynamo wants to retrieve data, save data, that kind of thing, and not do full table scans because you asked a question that didn't have a good index. It's not going to suddenly start doing a table scan to get the job done like a relational might. And so first we had this Dynamo paper that talked about some of these things and inspired a wide variety of databases to follow that path. And eventually this DynamoDB service that's now well over 10 years, I think maybe 12 or 13 years old, where The same technology that still today is powering a lot of Amazon.com features is available to the AWS customers. And its secret sauce really is it shards the data internally. I mean, I'm nerding out. Let me know if you don't want to, but shards it. So that
because you talked about, you know, the relational database, you know, not cutting it for .com. And in the traditional world, your next step would be, okay, my relational database can't cope. I will start sharding my relational database.
Right.
But this is like sharding, but there's way more than sharding going on here.
It's sharding, but where the database is responsible for the sharding. So the sharding goes into the database instead of being outside the database.
Which is nifty.
Like if you're thinking relational, how do I scale up? Well, I'm going to say it's beyond what one cluster can do, so I'm going to have N many clusters. And I'm going to have some sort of partition key, like a customer ID, which I will use in that request to know which of these backend clusters to send it to. That gets to be a nuisance because now you're dealing with a bunch of different cluster databases. Upgrading them is hard. And if a lot of user load starts to go to one, how do I split it? And so the core idea was, what if that clustering aspect was part of the database? And every item in DynamoDB has a partition key. We use that, hash it, to figure out which of these backend servers should get it, backend partitions should get it. And the splitting of the partitions, the management of them is something that the database does invisibly for you. So you get this advantage without you seeing N many clusters of Dynamo.
Let's start at a really, really important part. Long-term listeners know of my deep and abiding love for SQL and all things SQL because it's stood me in my last 35 years. It stood me well. And we'll talk about Particle at some point in this conversation. But, you know, when you move into the DynamoDB world, you can't reach for SQL. Like you said, some of those practices of I can write, you know, tight but lazy queries on my database and it'll give me an answer every time is completely different. So how do I forget about what I know with third normal form and Boyce-Codd normal form and all that other stuff? And how do I think about modeling my data effectively in a DynamoDB context?
Depending on who I talk to and what their background is, I will give different answers. One answer that I think as a programmer who came to databases first as a programmer and later working on the database side, but coming from the left, the programming side, is think of Dynamo as a really big, fast, persistent hash table of B-trees.
Mm.
And so the partition key is like the hash key lookup. We have a sort key, which is the B-tree, the sorted list. Think of a B-tree as a sorted list, basically, which is at the other end of that hash. And you can have as many items in this giant, persistent, fast hash table as you want. Generally, you'll have a partition key be something like a customer ID or a device ID or whatnot. And then around that, you might have a list of things that you know about that entity, which would be the sort key. And the sort key could be strings of like, I know A, B, C, D about it. It could be an order ID. And maybe it starts with order hash order IDs so that all my orders start with the same string so I can ask for them because a B-tree or a sorted list is always nice and keeps that data contiguous. I can get all my orders in one request. And so if I have a customer and I want to keep track of their orders in their shopping cart, I might have a cart hash pop followed by a cart ID for the entry. And I could see what's in their shopping cart by going to this hash table and saying this customer, going to the B tree, saying starts with this, and getting all the items out of the hash. So if you come at it from a programming point of view and you think, how would I model this if I had a giant, persistent, low latency hash table of B trees, it starts to get you there. We do have something called secondary indexes, global secondary indexes, which is another point of view on your data, which is kind of like a shadow table that has a different partition key, sort key combination. And so with that, if you say, well, instead of looking up always by customer ID, I want to say which customers have this in their shopping cart, I could use the secondary index to have that thing be the partition key. And it would be kind of a separately maintained, automatically maintained, eventually consistent off the base table set of items. It can be sparse as well. So if you only say things that are in some special state should go into the secondary index, you can do that and then go retrieve them. But that's kind of it. So how do I model my data that way? And it makes sense for a wide variety of things to say, well, if you gave me a hash table, I could do it. And you tend to put data that's going to be retrieved together in that same partition. We call it an item collection, things that have the same partition key. So I can go to user X and I can say, give me all about user X. I want their address. I want their shopping cart because they just logged in and I want everything right now. And you can go to, with one call, get all sorts of things about that person because you just did that hash table lookup and the sort of B tree of all the data from them.
I think when we think about a relational world, we think about the database and then we do our entity relational diagrams and we design it every possible sort of set of data, knowing that we can apply this general case query language to it and get answers and joins, et cetera. Whereas this is, we're kind of doing that work up front in terms of we want to understand our access patterns reasonably well. Also, we don't have to look at the world and say, well, everything has to be in DynamoDB. You can combine SQL and NoSQL quite comfortably as well, depending on your use case. But certainly for anything of a super high volume, low latency perspective, you're going to want to do that data modeling to get your access pattern right for your DynamoDB table because you don't want to be changing it later on too much, do you?
Yeah, it's true. We, when doing data modeling, we'll say, let's talk about what data you have to remember and what your access patterns are. And we make sure that we really grease those access patterns to be lightweight, therefore the lowest latency, the lowest cost. And many of the times you interact with things in the world, you think the service does a certain number of things, but it just does them at amazing scale, really reliably and fast. That's a good Dynamo use case.
Now, let's talk about accessing that data. So obviously, if I have a direct key, I can do a get item and get my thing back quickly. That's a no-brainer. That's easy. But what about querying when I have a set of conditions? How do I get access efficiently? Because as you said before, you can scan the database. It's like not the way you want to do it, but you could. But what's the more elegant way to query if you have some sort of conditions? And what kind of conditions can we play with?
We're very popular among video streaming services, and I think we all probably watch enough streaming TV that we're familiar with the kind of use case. And so let's data model that. The partition key is going to be you, probably, most of the time, my customer. And then my sort key might be your watch list. So it might say like watch, hash, and then a movie ID, or bookmarks of where you are in every show, book, hash, then a bookmark ID, or ratings, rating hash, and then some sort of rating ID, something like that. And I can go there and I can say when you first log in, maybe my console pulls down everything about you and it knows your ratings and it knows your bookmarks and everything and what I should show up on the screen. Or maybe you just want the ratings of a particular movie, right? So then I would say you rating movie ID, something like that, depending on how we choose to do ratings. Probably I'd do rating and then a movie ID would be the easiest way if I wanted to fetch that, or else I could get all your ratings by asking for every sort key that starts with rating hash. We use hash as a common indicator between the name mangling, the decoration of it, and then the ID oftentimes so that I can put more things in there. And this scales really well. And then if you maybe want to put your movies in there, you could have a different partition key, which is a movie. And in there, you'd have separate schemas in the same table. Yeah, every item can have a different schema. And so I can have movies and users existing. Maybe you don't want to. Maybe you do. One nice thing you noticed there was that I was putting things like bookmarks and ratings and watch list favoriting into the same table probably. And I did that so that I could retrieve all those different entity types in one request. By doing that, it's lower latency and also it's lower cost. We haven't talked about how do you price in something that doesn't have servers.
Yeah.
Right? It's not instance hours, tell you that much. But generally, it is by read units and write units, these read capacity units and write capacity units, which is kind of in 4 KB chunks of data retrieved for reads and 1 KB chunks of data written. So if I can retrieve a long list of your movie ratings and it all fits in 4 KB, it still just costs that one unit. So putting that together can be very advantageous. And we learned this, we called it single table design, when we were migrating many of the Amazon.com properties over to DynamoDB. And we did that for mostly resilience, lower cost, better performance, you know, the lower latency. But we learned some techniques like that. I think the original question was, how do I think about the data modeling? I look at, in that case, saying, this is what I need to do. And if I want to learn about a movie with its thumbnails, then I can look it up by the movie ID. And maybe I have a movie category, that's a good secondary index. So if I say, give me thrillers, it would give me under the thriller partition key, give me the list of movies that are thrillers. And then from those, I could go maybe do get item because, you know, 100 thrillers, I go off and I pull those so I can get their thumbnail art, something like that.
And related to that is also the, obviously the paging of information coming back. So if I'm doing a query and saying, hey, give me a whole bunch of stuff. And let's say the data set is 20 meg coming back. I'm not getting 20 meg in the first call, am I? I'm getting no. 1 meg from memory.
We refuse to do unbounded slow work. If you do ask for a query or something of give me my ratings and I've rated every movie, you will get 1 megabyte. Today's the limit. You get the first megabyte along with a bookmark that says, happy to give you more. Ask again using this bookmark and we'll resume where we left off and you get the next chunk. Which is an important thing to do on a multi-tenant backend. I don't want any one person just to consume a lot of resources.
Crazy queries going out and chewing stuff up. So it is a design consideration to think about. Actually, speaking of data modeling again, data types. What are the data types that you see being used most successfully within DynamoDB? What do customers like to put in there?
Oh, interesting question. You have strings, of course, and a lot of times partition keys and sort keys will say to use strings even if you're thinking you might want them as a number because it gives you that flexibility later to say maybe it's a user ID today, but I'm actually going to make it a string that is user hash user ID because later I might want movie hash movie ID in there. And that movie hash is like a string constant, and then afterwards is the variable, the movie ID, and that way I can have users and movies in the same table should I want it. Maybe those don't ever query together, so maybe I put them in different tables. But if you're going to query different entity types at the same time, you might want them in the same table, so then strings are good. You can have numbers, of course. We just have numbers, no difference between the rest, like floats and nothing like that. It's a number. Yeah. And Boolean. And the other ones that kind of, I think, come up a lot, map and list and set. Mm. And so we use the map if it's going to be JSON. So a lot of people will store JSON data, and that's natural with a map. I will give out a little pro tip. If you're going to store JSON, but it's just payload, it's just along for the ride, I do see people use a map there, but that's requiring that the database store it as a map and internally represented as a map, when you could probably just store it as a string or a compressed string and therefore make it a binary because we have a binary type too. And so a string or a binary type that's that JSON, if the JSON is just going along for the ride. Now, why would I want the JSON to do something? Well, if I want to go and view just a section of the JSON and ask the database, just give me this little bit, okay, well, then it better be understood by the database. If I want to update some aspect inside the JSON, then, well, the database needs to understand it as JSON. But if I'm just saying, you know what, and a lot of times this is the case, going to decorate your whatever, so-and-so data as this is the JSON payload, then pro tip, store it as a string or a compressed string.
Nice.
And it'll save space, and you don't have to have the overhead of marshaling the data in and out.
Mm.
You can decide later, you know, is it worth expanding? You can take your own compression algorithm, your own JSON parser, and everything like that.
Clever. Now, one of the things that I love about DynamoDB, and there's many things I love about it, is it does a whole lot of really cool, fancy stuff, but you don't have to do a lot of work to get it. One of my favorites I'd love you to talk about is time to live, because it's different from, again, a relational world where we chuck data in and it lives there forever unless we choose to delete it. TTL gives us a completely different mental model around data storage. So why do we have it and how would you use it?
Yeah, when you load data, a lot of times you have data that's really relevant right now, but after a while, 30 days, 90 days, a year, it's not really important to keep anymore. And we have two things to help you with such situations. One is we do have different table classes, a standard table class and a standard infrequent access table class. So if you're saying, I want to keep it, but my data is going to be really big, we can do standard IA and it would be lower storage cost. And people have done that. But the other thing you can do is this TTL time to live, where you have on the item the date of its death. The item knows when it's going to die.
It's all over, man. Like a game sci-fi over. Movie.
It's like a sci-fi movie where you can look at your wrist and know your date of death. And when that time passes, that says to the database it's eligible for deletion. And what's cool is we'll delete it for free.
Mm-hmm.
So you can insert the data and know that at a certain time, that data is just going to be swept away. And you don't have to have a write cost to get rid of it. And therefore, the storage is going to be limited. It's not going to grow forever. I'm glad you're asking about it, because one of the things we specialists talk about is the number of people who load their data and don't think about TTL until it's been a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And we get that call of, so I've got 3 years of data and I really don't need it all. How do I delete the old stuff? Well, you can, but they're kind of wishing that they could delete it without any cost.
Yeah.
TTL gives you that no cost delete with one caveat, which is it's eligible for deletion at that time, but we don't promise to delete it that second.
Mm-hmm. It's an eventually consistent delete.
Yeah, kind of. It's when the servers that hold the data say, I got a little free time. Yeah. Then we go off and we do that housekeeping for you. And that's why we don't charge you for it, because we want to fill in any sort of possible lulls in activity and do some free work for our customers. So they really like the TTL feature.
Nice. Another capability is global tables. So the ability to replicate data globally across multiple tables. And it's not just replication, because as hard as that is, that's not nearly as hard as read-write replication between regions. That's a whole next level. So why do we have sort of this multi-region capability, and how do I think about it again from an application modeling perspective?
This is going to be my longest answer. I wrote 25 pages on this recently.
I'm talking to the right person.
As a global, global table prescriptive guidance, the best ways to use global tables. So there's a few reasons that you do it. One is lower latency. I think people think about disaster recovery as a reason, but sometimes people say, you know, I have users all over the world and I want them to have the lowest latency experience. And if all my data is in one particular region, then there's oceans to cross and that can add up. You know, speed of light,
physics,
just not getting any faster.
Physics is a thing.
Speed of light. Yeah, speed of light 2.0. So by replicating the data with global tables, you create a table in one region and you say, I want extra copies in these other regions, continuously syncing all the time with the expected typical sub-second latency for the replication. Again, depends on speed of light and whatnot. But now people have copies of the data near them. So that's a great use case. So I can always access, read my data nearby. It's like, the other one is that disaster recovery. What do I do should, for any reason, I want to get out of a particular region and move my traffic to another region? And if you do that, if you use global tables, you go from 4 nines SLA with DynamoDB to 5 nines, because we have that extra redundancy. I do think that people think about it as, what do I do if DynamoDB in one region should have issues and I need to use a DynamoDB in another region? But I encourage people to think, it's what if I have any issue in one region and want to evacuate my traffic from there and move to another region, because Dynamo is really, really resilient.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe the issue is that you just did a deployment that messed something up. You're not even sure what yet, but you say, let me get my traffic. Well, the fact that Dynamo is continuously replicating your data means you have a clone of your data in another region ready to go. So if you can get your application stack there because you had it already, or you can quickly build it, well, you've got a copy of your data and you can get out of region A. Or if some other service in A, something you depend on is, I don't know, like, I'm just getting higher latencies than I'd like, you know? Well, let's hit the button and evacuate. And global tables are active-active, meaning that you can write to any region and it's continuously replicating, which very hard to do
very
that
hard.
Relational just because of how it does third normal form. So if you're item-oriented, we call them items instead of rows, this item I write here can replicate over there. Every item has its primary key. And so the primary key here writes over there it writes over to here. And that means that I'm continuously copying the data. And for any reason, I encourage people to instrument their applications to look for anything that goes wrong. Don't be thinking, well, Dynamo is what's going to go wrong. Think, maybe I didn't bet IAM deployment and something's not working. Maybe it's some other service that's just higher latency. That's the typical issue that you'll want to face. In that case, you can have other regions backing you up. Then, active-active, how do you do active-active? Like, do I want active-active? Dynamo global tables are always active-active. You can write to the item anywhere. What if I write to the same item at the same time, the same primary key at the same time in two regions? What happens? Do you want to take a guess? Do you already know?
I haven't tested it myself. I know time is an important factor and time stamping is an important factor, but how does it figure out what is the right one?
Right. It is the last time stamp wins. So the last write wins, which we're kind of used to on file systems and whatnot. So if I write to the same item in the same second slow enough that one write hasn't fully replicated, then this other write is going to be the one that is declared the winner. And we want that because we want it to eventually agree across all regions what the very latest value is. So we do that. But so then that means, what do I do about that? Like, is that okay? Well, some writes are idempotent, meaning, you know, safely repeatable. So if you're updating your address, I'll actually use video streaming, which we did before as an easy one. You are updating your bookmark. This one, the client can talk to any region. You can talk to region A, B, C. Here's my timestamp. Here's as you're watching your favorite show. And the last updated timestamp is probably the one that you want to win. And if I don't care which region the client talks to. And I kind of like when a client can just use Route 53 or or whatnot, Global Accelerator, to pick the nearest region, the lowest latency region. It does all its reads and writes from there. My writes are idempotent, and I'm okay if the middle Route 53 changes my access from one region to another in the middle. None of my business. Don't care. But maybe I want to do something where my writes are conditional on the existing value.
Mm.
So update the item, but only if something about the item. That's harder to do if you're going to update the same item in different regions. So something that people do is they say, well, all my writes I'm going to send to one region and the other ones will be kind of like read-only replicas. Now, Dynamo would let you write to them, but you just make sure that you don't route traffic to them so they don't take the writes until you do a failover. And then you say, okay, now my writes are going here. And some financial services customers, for example, do a follow the sun model where all the writes are wherever the sun is shining. Now, why do they do that? They do that so that everybody around the world gets low latency reads, where it's business hours gets low latency writes. Mm,
that makes sense.
If you write in a dark zone, you'd have to route your message over to the region that's live. So now low latency where it matters, redundancy as well. So if the place where the sun is shining, they need to evacuate, they can move it to the next one. And
so on and so forth.
Works just fine. Right. Or sometimes people will say, well, I want everybody to get low latency, like say video game. Mm. We see a lot of video game applications. So you are going to be homed on a certain place and I will route your traffic to one region, but I will make sure that you don't do your writes to any other region. So some people write to one region, some write to another, but we keep track of everybody's home region. Mm-hmm. So you're never writing the same item at the same time. So sometimes I don't care if I write the same item around the same time. And sometimes I route to all one region and sometimes I write to different regions, but just making sure that the streams like Ghostbusters don't intersect.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a distinctive advantage for Dynamo to have this. The active-active is just so nice. How do I fail? Or what's the procedure? Send your traffic to the other region.
Do very little. It's a wonderful feature. One of the other features that I've been using personally lately, so it's close to my heart because it's really handy, that I think a lot of folks maybe haven't noticed is streaming. So the ability to accept a stream of data off the DynamoDB table to do other stuff with. So for example, you can send the data to a Lambda function. You can send it to lots of places. Like, how do you like to think about that capability and where does it fit for customer activities?
It's a really common pattern for people to want to observe the mutations that happen on a table. You set up a stream. You can do triggers, like you say, where you invoke a Lambda, and that's so integrated that you just say, this Lambda should be invoked for changes in that table. And you don't have to think much more about it. All the background processing is done for you. And you can even add a filter to say, particularly, I care about changes like this. And then you get your Lambdas invoked and you can, Lambda functions invoked, technically, I should say. And you can control your concurrency and things like that. And then people do a wide variety of things. They feed that data to a downstream consumer. For example, an OpenSearch index, for example. We have zero ETL with OpenSearch. Before that, you'd have to do this. And basically, this is how that zero ETL works under the covers. So now it's fully managed, but still using the same CDC capabilities. Or you sometimes will update the database again. So if you want to keep a tally of something, one way to do it is you let the write happen, you see the stream, and then you update the tally saying, well, that happened once more. It's another way to create any sort of event-based processing system where you place your order, put something in a shopping cart, whatever the activity is, and then the stream can let downstream consumers be aware that that happened, take the right action. And it's guaranteed exactly once delivery in the stream. That's a tough guarantee, but we do guarantee exactly once in the stream.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the powerful parts of it is you're not messing with any inconsistencies there. It's happening. Like in my particular use case, I'm monitoring I'm using DynamoDB as a metadata store. And when something happens, something gets inserted, then I know that means that there's something has been stored in S3 to go and look at, and my Lambda goes and does something based on that completely automagically, which is nice.
Some people will catch the TTL delete and write it to S3.
That's good.
So Dynamo says, I'm going to do a delete. You see that this was a TTL-based delete, and you can filter on such a thing and say, well, I'm going to put that in S3 for later storage. Nice, easy way to do it, right? Once you see it, you start to see a lot of different possibilities off it.
Yeah, lots of ways of using it. Let's talk backups. Some pretty nifty backup capability in DynamoDB because, you know, clearly it's been built to store a lot of really important customer data so that they can do important things for their customers with it. And logical data corruption, i.e. I'm a developer and I did the wrong thing. Not that I would have ever done that before, Jason. You know I'm completely robust in my coding practices. What are my options in terms of data recovery, data protection? Like what comes out of the box?
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of different backups, a deep subject. What you're talking about has something called point-in-time recovery, PITR, like the pitter-patter of little feet, P-I-T-R. And it's just a radio button that you turn on. And there's a monthly per gigabyte of table size cost for it. But what it lets us do is remember all the changes that you're making to the table. And with that, you can go back up to 35 days or the time you turned it on, whichever shorter. And you can say, restore my table as it was at this previous point. So if you corrupt data at noon, you can go to 11:59 and get the data before you did the silly thing. I do want to point out, though, that there's a new thing you can do now, which is another way to solve this. You keep PITR on, but you can also now do an incremental export. An incremental export says, show me the changes that happened in this time window, kind of like a diff in code. And it will say, at the beginning of the time, the item looked like this. At the end, it looked like this for every item that had a change, along with the timestamp of when. So if you did something silly at noon, you can now do an incremental export that covers the noon window, and it will lay out all the changes that happened right then, and you can figure out which one were your mistakes, and then you can roll it back.
That's nice.
Because you can see right there the before and the after. So I'm kind of spreading the word on this, because before we had incremental added, it's a fairly recent feature, you would do a restore before, and I'd have two copies of your table and compare
them. That's what I need.
But to be able to see just what happened, it's basically your visibility into the write-ahead log that's going in the database. And with that, it's very powerful. It's designed for downstream consumption. So we talked about CDC, but another thing you could do is every hour or 15 minutes, you could say, show me what's changed. And you could take that binary thing in S3 and say, all right, put it into an Apache Iceberg table. And now you've got an analytical version of your data. And you could always do it with CDC streams live pushing, but you know what? It's bulk. Iceberg kind of likes to just get a big bulk thing to write. So do regularly, monk, here's what's new, write it in. And I have an analysis. I wrote a blog on that, on the techniques to update an Iceberg table. And it gives you analytics against your Dynamo table, because Dynamo is an OLTP database, not an OLAP database.
Yes, yes.
But if you want that analytics, let's say that one once more.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Let's pause and restate that, because this is the important part, because you can't make it do what it's not designed to do. You can force it, but it ain't going to be a great experience. So it is a transactional database. It is not an analytics database.
It has transactions too. You can do ACID transactions on it, but it's about low latency. It's not about doing lots and lots of processing. So we do that external, or we keep track in advance. Like if you want to know accounts of things, your current running total, you can have a CDC stream fire. And when things happen, you update a total so that you can go quickly retrieve the total because it was pre-kept. Mm. That's a common pattern. But you don't on the fly process a million rows or items here to figure out the total.
Count Esther where key equals. Mm. Now, on that topic, it's going to be interesting to see your perspective on this. So as I said, being a unapologetic SQL fan, when I saw that Particle existed, which is kind of like SQL-ish that you can run on your DynamoDB table, it lets you do some interesting stuff. Like you can do some SQL-like queries on your DynamoDB table, can't you, if you want to?
All right.
I went there, Jason. I went there.
All right, Simon. So Particle, which is the cutest name ever, P-A-R-T-I-Q-L, capital Q-L, so like part of query language, Particle, is something that's added. It allows you to do SQL, but it lets you do the set of SQL that you could do with the regular API.
Yes. It's very limited.
If what you express in SQL could have been done, could be done with a vanilla API, then you can run it, which, okay, but it's kind of like I speak French so long as the word is entrepreneur.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Don't get your expectations of, oh, I'm going to be doing full ANSI SQL 92 with joins and group and having and all that, because that's not a thing Dynamo does. It lets you express in the familiar syntax the things that Dynamo can do. It does do a few things extra, which is kind of just interesting because it was built a little bit later. It has like a batch update, which is not something that the vanilla DynamoDB API can do. So some people who are really in the know of Dynamo will go to Particle in order to get the, it does a little extra thing here, a little extra thing there, that kind of thing. So sometimes, you know, when you're really figuring out all the nooks and crannies of your database, that is a reason to do Particle. And it's designed for someone who says, I want to do a select where. And so long as your select where fits within the general umbrella of what DynamoDB can do with a couple extra areas around the edge, then it works for you. But yeah, I don't want you to think that you're getting all of SQL 92.
You're definitely not. But it's fun to know that it's there if you need it. And I often just use it in the console quickly just to, you know, if I'm poking around. It's often
that's a great place for it, actually.
It's the quickest way to poke around. Type, yeah, it's like, yeah.
It is great for console or command line or whatnot. Yeah. It's a great way. Yeah.
So it's useful for troubleshooting, for like, yeah, like I say, poking around at data just to see if, particularly if you're not working in DynamoDB all the time, which I don't. So for me, it's like, well, let me grab this comfy pair of shoes, aka SQL. I don't have to remember how to do my queries using the API.
So you go to your NoSQL database and write SQL. Is that what you're saying?
I didn't say that specifically, but you're probably right. That's probably the accurate answer. Now, something else that Dynamo does very, very well is permissions and granular permissions. Can you talk to us a little bit about how I think about my permissions at the table level, but more importantly, the row and the field level?
What's really cool about it is that unlike relational databases that have a password involved, here it's entirely IAM based. So if you have a role that can see a table, then you can see the table. If you have a role that can see the item, then you can see the item. Typically done with leading keys in the fine-grained access control with IAM is what you'd want to look for if you're interested in the row level. But we actually added resource-based policies recently where now the table can also define who's allowed or what roles are allowed to access it. So you kind of do it forward or backward now. And that's really great for cross-account access because it used to be more difficult to have account A access a table in account B. And now so long as the table in account B says that role in A is allowed, then it's allowed and no more fancy dance to get it done. So it's quite native how the security works using IAM. And yeah, it does have fine-grained access control where you can control what items available using the leading keys, or even which attributes are available to somebody.
Yeah.
I think you might be thinking it's more commonly used than it is. It's not the most commonly used because generally there's some middleware that does a lot of enforcement to make sure that the right things are given to the right people and people aren't directly accessing the database, where you really want to make sure that there's a user ID that is limited to do only what they're supposed to do.
I have to admit, I get a kick out of that functionality because I had to build that middleware many, many, many years ago for a project I was working on. And so I know how hard it is to make that work. And so I love the work that's gone into making this work. Like I look back at that project, this is like in the 90s. I look back at that project, oh my God, it would have been, 2 days of work.
Yeah, it's really
done. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. FGAC would be the thing to Google for when you want to see the nuts and bolts of that.
There you go.
Fine-grained access control.
Let's talk about briefly capacity. Back in the day when DynamoDB first came out, you had to think about your write capacity and your read capacity when you created your table. And you still can. But a while ago, a new little option came of saying, just do it for me. I don't want to worry about it anymore.
Yeah, on demand.
That's the word. Thank you. And let me tell you that I don't create tables that are not on demand anymore because that's the world I live in because it's very spiky type stuff. You know, nothing, nothing, nothing. Lots of stuff, nothing, nothing, nothing. Tell us about the options there in terms of thinking about planning out that. Because also there's obviously provision capacity as well. There's lots of, you know, choices. But as a developer and then as an operator, what do I think about in terms of the sizing and capacity of my tables?
We've come a long way over the years, 12 or 13 years, from the early days where you'd really have to tell us a lot about what to expect to now where we say, we'll react.
Yeah.
And that's the on-demand. Yeah. And so if you make your table on-demand, you're saying, just answer the request, darn it.
Yep.
I don't want to give you any hints about what's coming. I don't want to tell you about the read-write rate. And what we do on the back end is we manage by watching what's going on, and we make sure that we always have enough capacity to handle double what you've ever seen before. And we just keep the oomph on the database, the number of partitions and whatnot, there so that you can do that. And then your build on a per request basis, your read request units and your write request units. There's no maintaining some sort of per second. So it's, if it's TV, it's what I pay by the show, you know, watch a show, there's a little charge there, watch a show, a little charge there. There's no sort of, I want to watch these many shows per this much time or whatnot. Mm. And very convenient. Great when you spike up and go down. Great when you don't know that the workload that's coming. Some people do it when they know that they have a real special event and they just want maximum responsiveness. And it's just the sportiest of sports cars in reactiveness. You know, you can literally be ice cold and then immediately be taking massive amounts of traffic. I mean, even a million would be possible after being ice cold for a month if you were in on-demand mode. And if the table on the back end had the capacity, because you once had done, you know, say 500,000, and, you know, if your usage was fairly flat across the table, so good spread across your customer base, right? Then you could go from ice cold to super hot just right away. That's really cool. Yeah. Wasn't available at the beginning. Yeah. Some people would prefer to give us hints. They tell us, you know what, I kind of want to do the 10,000 a second reads, 5,000 a second writes. That's provisioned mode. You tell us how much your cost is, the 10,000 per second times some sort of hourly rate, and it's a little bit more like a subscription model. And that can be cost advantageous because you're giving us knowledge. You're telling us what's coming. Mm. And so we, you know, thank you. You can get some better costing that way. One tip I want to tell you that I'm you know, is if you know that you're going to have a big table and someone like you exactly doing the on-demand at the start, but let's say you're doing an on-demand table and you're a big bank. I had this conversation with a big bank. You want to pre-warm that on-demand table so that it knows that it's going to be a heavy hitting table. And so if you create it out of the blue, the docs will say this is going to be able to, it basically has to assume a previous high watermark.
Yeah.
So it's like, how big a table am I? Well, how big was I? And so at birth, it says, well, I've seen 2,000 writes a second and I've seen 12,000 reads a second, or I think something like that. That means that you could do with a 4,000, 24,000, maybe it was 6,000 reads, 6,000 reads. So up to 12,000 RCUs would be a peak and 4,000 WCUs would be a peak. Yeah, I think that's right. But maybe you know that you're going to send way more traffic than that. All right. So what you'd want to do then is you want to provision the table at the level you're going to actually receive. So that makes the table bigger.
Yep.
And then you can make it on demand immediately after it's been created as a way to, now you're in the on-demand model, but you have a
your
table.
Your baseline is
more oomph.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes I see people like have a new table every day and at midnight they make a new on-demand table. And I see that they have some throttles for the first 30 minutes. Mm. And those throttles are what happens when you're sending more traffic than your table has capacity for on the back end. And it is rapidly expanding. So after 30 minutes, it's got all the oomph that they need. And they never noticed.
Yeah. Yeah.
The throttles just created a bit of a higher latency because the client automatically retried. Yep. It always succeeded. But I can say, you know, I see these throttles every day between 12, 12:15, 12 to 12:30. Why don't you make the table provisioned with more capacity and then switch it to on demand? It's kind of funny. You can go on staging and do performance testing against a table and it does great, right? Because you've abused that table. Yeah. It is really fully. Then you go production with a new table. Well, that new production table, it's like Arnold Schwarzenegger getting a much smaller arm on his left arm, you know, for production. Like, no. Birth your left arm big so that it's as strong as that right arm that you've been working on. And so for that customer, I said, you know that you're going to get this big traffic. Create the table big, then switch on demand. And they did that. So I'm just spreading that because it is a...
That's a great tip. And it's an easy one too. Because I mean, it's just like you just one extra command to get it done. And if you're doing it automatically, it's just one extra line of code, really.
Some people think they have to send the traffic to warm the table, but you don't. You just have to once provision it big and we say, all right, well, we'll now be large. I wish I could do that with my muscles.
Yeah, I know. I'll sign up. Jason, when you develop that, I'm signing up. I'm there.
Just a hint. Like, I would like to be strong. And the body goes, well, then, okay, I'll be strong.
I'll make you strong.
But no, we have to send the darn traffic in order to gain the strength, right. But not with a database. So on-demand, very powerful. Another thing I want to spread, if you've been using Dynamo for a long time, meaning like over 5 years ago, and I still see some people who are old-time DynamoDB users, we used to have a thing called throughput dilution, which meant that if you'd allocated a certain amount of capacity, read capacity to your table, and we have more partitions on the back end, each partition would get allotted a section of that throughput. And so more partitions could cause this dilution where you had to worry about, oh man, if I send too much traffic to one of those, it doesn't have the full share of capacity of my table. It only gets its little share. That's long gone.
Yay.
That's not an issue anymore. That capacity is managed at the table level, not at the partition level. There are still some per partition read-write limits of like 3,000 read units, 1,000 write units. That's the limit right now. But if you allocate 100,000 to your table, that's at the table. You don't have to worry about
what's happening under the covers.
I've got too many partitions and it's been split out. So yeah.
That's awesome.
It's always cool when I encounter someone who's like used Dynamo 8 years ago.
Yeah, it's good to.
And I can be like, oh, we've been working.
Yeah, it's good to. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, every time I dive into Dynamo, there's new things that are like, oh, it does this, does that. And I think that's one of the reasons for this episode is, you know, lots of our listeners use Dynamo, like lots. That's a technical term. And so it's good to revisit things that we're comfortable with and that we've used for a long time, because like you say, there's this amazing number of Two Pizza teams working on this stuff all the time, listening to customers, improving things, adding new features that you may not know are there. I think, Jason, this has been a really good walkthrough, just like a tip of the iceberg, as it were, of things that are going on. And clearly, you're quite prolific in writing about this. And so we're going to share some links in the show notes and other tips and tricks that you can use. But Jason, before we close, given us a few really good tips, give us one little quick one, like a quality of life tip that you like to use in your own work with DynamoDB that you think others may benefit from. I mean, I've got to say that the capacity one is already worth the price of admission. So this is like the cherry on top of the cream on the icing.
Keep talking while I think of one. I help customers. The cost is $0 to bring someone like me on to help you out. I think I'll say that. And so sometimes people will launch and maybe have some sort of issue in their schema design or something, but they didn't get it reviewed first. I cost, you know, nothing to the end user. We want you successful. And so there are a variety of specialists who live and breathe Dynamo, love to talk to you about your use case. And if you're going to go live, we'll look at your schema, tell you, okay, here's something else you could do. Oh, maybe a little tweak here. I can maybe get you from painting yourself into a corner. Like, you know, the on-demand tip.
Yeah,
you're using on-demand. That's great. Now, what's your hour one traffic? Okay, let me tell you something here. Or, you know, maybe your data type, like the JSON thing. Like, oh, okay, JSON. Do you need the database to understand that? Should we model it as a map or should we just do it as a compressed string? Things like that, maybe SDK. Well, that's this better SDK, that better SDK. Should I have a cache or not? I love to help customers, love to hear what they're doing and try to provide a little, like, oh, that's 90% right, but let me give you 10% that you wouldn't notice for a year from now. But
you'll thank me later.
Everybody at all stages of maturity, you'll thank me later. Pitter or TTL.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We covered that. Yep. Did you do TTL? Do it.
Yeah, do it now.
Otherwise, 4 years from now, you're going to want to get rid of 3 years of data and you're going to have a challenge. Whereas if you turn on TTL now with a 365, or maybe say just do a 2-year delete, you know, a TTL 2 years in the future, you know that you'll never have accumulation of more than 2 years of data, and you know that everything then, and maybe later on you'll tighten it up or something. So get a chance for a specialist like me to talk to you and give you that check over, work through a schema design, lots of interesting discoveries that way. And yeah, as you say, I talk to customers all day. It's the best part of the job. And then I write up a blog or a guidance, which is trying, we have over 1 million customers. I can't talk to everyone. So I put into these blogs the things that I want people to know that I can't just do one-on-one.
Sounds good. Jason, thanks again for coming on the show and telling us a little bit more about DynamoDB.
Thanks for great questions. It's been fun.
It has been. And we do love to get your feedback. AWS podcast at amazon.com is the place to do it. And until next time, keep on building.